You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Welcome, listeners, to another episode of A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. Good morning to Matt.
Hey, Sam.
And to Julie.
Good morning.
Who are joining me this morning for our third episode in our summer series, Lost Summer, in which we talk about lost films, lost filmmakers, and lost eras of filmmaking. And in this episode, we're not really aiming to open up a Pandora's box, but look into something that we came to call the poison cabinet in film history. The very productive era between 1933 and 1945 during the reign of Nazi Germany. This is a difficult subject, a difficult era, and it is my pleasure that you two have agreed to join me to talk about this and look into filmmaking that was often seen as highly problematic after 1945, that has been somewhat reappreciated, but very critically also looked at again as propaganda cinema. And I wanted to ask you, first of all, Julie, when we planned this episode, what were maybe your thoughts, your hesitations at actually looking at this era in cinema? Should we look at it? Why not? What were your thoughts?
Well, with some trepidation, I thought it would be important to talk about this because nothing has ever been served by hiding it under the carpet. But I think that it's problematic to try and look back to this era because it was a very specific bubble and a very specific regime. And it's very hard, I think, in retrospect, to do either of two things, to look inside from the outside, but to also understand what the inside must have been like at the time, right? This was a very regimented culture of propaganda. And I think the idea of this propaganda was not so much that everybody had to believe every lie that the regime put out, but to erode the distinction that there is a meaningful difference between truth and lies at all. It's as Aaron says, right? The idea of the masses is in imagination, not in truth. You can't communicate with the masses with facts. You have to communicate with them through feelings. So it's a very dangerous thing that you're playing with. So in that sense, I find it hard to talk about because it's a different world from ours. We know propaganda, we know censorship, we know about the 50s, right, and the 30s. But this is such a regimented time that it's very hard to say something meaningful about these films. And also, on the other hand, it's very tempting to read things into them, to go to them with questions you need answered. The important questions, the very logical, why, how did this happen? How did people get bamboozled? What were they told? What weren't they told? These questions will not be answered through the Reich's cinema in the same way that when you watch the new Leni Riefenstahl documentary, it's very good, very frustrating, but very good. Journalists and writers keep confronting her with her lies, saying like, this cannot be true. What you said cannot be true. And they can't get any meaningful answers out of her except tantrums because the truth is not the point. The lie is the point. The self-mythologizing is the point. The truth has become completely meaningless. And it's very hard to watch a movie arming yourself against that fact, is that what you're looking at is a cinema which has been built around making the distinction between truth and lies completely unimportant. And let's not pretend that this is not currently, there is no very fertile ground for these ideas to be planted in. So also don't let's underestimate the power that these films still have to do exactly what they were designed to do, namely plant ideas without your even necessarily noticing that they're being planted. So I think shaky ground, Sam, shaky ground.
Matt, how do you feel about planning this episode and diving into this kind of cinema? Do you share Julie's trepidations? Are they similar? Do they come from a different vantage point?
I think I definitely share some of Julie's thoughts on this. My perspective here is, I think, also partly defined by when I was at uni, I did literature as a major, but I did history as a minor. I didn't cover the period that we're talking about here, but I think just how to address cultural products, I can compartmentalize relatively well in that, you know, I can look at, for instance, these films as historical sources, which they also are. And historical sources, you don't have to agree with them. You don't have to like them. You look at, you know, what do you find in there? What is expressed? How can you place them into a context? So I think looking at those two films, I didn't have this notion of, ugh, I'm going to be watching Nazi films. It was like, this could be interesting, even if I'm not going to like them as films, probably. At the same time, even if part of me is, you know, this historian who thinks he can compartmentalize, there are certain things that I have a gut reaction to. I know that, for instance, footage of Hitler speaking, I find mystifying, but I also find repulsive. Any of the Goebbels speeches or whatever, I do have a almost physical reaction to that based, again, on the history, you know, not as a historian, but knowing what these things pertain to. You know, for instance, in one of the two films that we have, the film seems very innocuous. And then suddenly someone basically greets someone else with Heil Hitler. And I almost jumped in my seat. I didn't expect it. Also, and especially because the film up to that point seemed so innocuous. So I am in two minds, and those two minds are kind of a bit clashing here. But I do still think, you know, to some extent, we can look at these things as historical sources and look at them from that perspective. We don't have to like them. We don't have to agree with them. But we have to kind of possibly activate different parts of our kind of critical faculties when watching them. How about you, Sam?
Well, I totally agree with what you said about, you know, coming at them as historical sources. For me, it was that, you know, as someone who studied history, who's been teaching it for many years now, I think I've come to look at World War II, obviously, as a subject that I teach at, like you said, the documentary excerpts, the speeches, the pictures, the posters, as something that we regularly deal with and analyze with my students. And it's become just something that is, you know, part of the curriculum and obviously super important in critical analysis and understanding of the mechanics of propaganda. But it was the documentary Hitler's Hollywood of 2017 by Rüdiger Süssland that I saw shortly after it came out at our favorite Cinema Rex. And it just confronted me with something that I hadn't really thought about, the fact that there had been an extremely productive film industry that wasn't just putting out pure propaganda. You know, we tend to think of Liefenstahl, we tend to think of Jud Süß by Veit Harlan, especially when we think of Nazi Germany and its films, even its feature films, as something that is blatant propaganda. But the film, the documentary, so convincingly gave an insight, opened this box that we mentioned before, this poison cabinet, and peeked inside and said, well, there were very different films in there, and they were very different in their strategies, in their styles, in their genre. And some of them, you know, his basic message was it's something that we shouldn't look away from, what we should look at, not in a sense of excusing them or making them seem, you know, non-propaganda or coming at them from very different points of view, reappreciating them as great films, but rather as an expression of how people thought, dreamt, what their maybe aspirations, their feelings were at the time, and obviously also the more subtle ways in which propaganda was instilled in them. So ever since I saw that documentary film, Hitler's Hollywood, I thought, you know, that would be a very challenging but very worthwhile and interesting look at not the most obvious and blatant examples of Nazi propaganda, but maybe the insidious ways in which it seeped into the minds of people who went to see a movie at the cinema, maybe innocently wanted to be, you know, wanted to escape their everyday life and aspire to something that wasn't just, you know, the victory of Hitler and the Nazis, but they were living their everyday lives. And how do these films work? And you mentioned it already, Matt, we actually focused on two films in particular that we're going to look at. But that was kind of my point of view, where I came from at this project. And I'm glad we're here and we're doing this. So shall we delve into our two films? Maybe just to mention what they are. We picked two films, like I said, that are not, at least at first glance, blatant examples of propaganda. Or are they? The first one is called Großstadt Melodie, released in 1943, filmed mostly in 1942. I think context of the years is important here, especially with regard to when they were filmed and when they were released. The second one is Opfergang, filmed mostly in 42, 43, and only released in late 44. And maybe just to begin with, why did we choose these films? We had a longer discussions here, and Großstadt Melodie came up as our first film. So maybe a little bit of context. Did you know about this film before? Had you heard about it before? Did you suggest it for analysis? Julie, what can you say about the first film?
I wanted, when you pitched this idea to me, I was very interested in, towards the end of the war, a lot of propaganda was aimed at women because they were the ones left and they were supposed to protect the house and hearth and sublimate themselves and their identities and all their will to the greater glory of the Reich. And some of these films are very interesting because they give an illusion of agency. They read to our modern eyes almost like feminist pieces, like they were made in America in the 30s. But they are very much not that. So I thought it would be interesting to just clear our minds and watch this film from beginning to end and see what we see now and see how this propaganda creeps into this film that seems like almost enlightened, right? It seems very modern. The style of filming is very modern. It's one of those urban stories that the late Nazi era was so in love with. They love urban stories. It's filmed in Berlin before the bombing, so it has some historical interest in that the places that we see no longer exist and, incidentally, didn't exist anymore when the film was released. Much of it had been bombed. So this is a film in which, in several layers, the illusion speaks to us from the past very much. The illusion of female agency, the illusion of modernity, the illusion of a city that, by the time that this film came around, no longer existed. Right. So to me, there are several of these types of films, one featuring Ingrid Bergman. Very interesting, the only Nazi film she ever made. Also one of those semi-feminist pieces. So that was my thought. I wanted to find one of these types of films that celebrated a modernity that the Nazi ideology obviously wasn't a fan of, just to give you a sort of imaginary out of the drudgery of your existence in wartime. And I plumped for this one because it really is a fun film. Right up to the ending when you go like, what the actual double-edged hockey sticks is going on with this film? If you don't know what the context is, you will not understand the ending at all. It's like total whiplash. You have to understand that this is essentially a Nazi propaganda film from the ground up made by a Nazi filmmaker to the end of pitching this idea that you have some sort of agency in this world, which you obviously do not. So it's also a fun film. This is going to sound really weird, but it's one of those, a country girl from Bavaria goes to the big city to seek her fortune and she finds her best friend, a male best friend without any romance, etc. So it's really modern feeling, right? So that's why I chose it. It's almost, it seems almost diametrically opposed to the regime when in fact it is a tool of it.
Matt, had you heard of Großstadt Melodie prior to our podcast? Had you seen it? And what was your reaction upon seeing it first or second time?
I hadn't seen it. I hadn't heard of it. I also, basically, apart from, you know, the very big names, as you mentioned, Jutsus or then the Leni Riefenstahl films, I didn't really know many or any kind of Nazi films. In that respect, I came to it. I mean, it's difficult. You come to these films, or I came to these films, you expect to see a certain thing. And I didn't find what I expected. I expected something much more blatantly ideologically propagandistic in the sense of this is Nazi ideology. This is what we're purveying. This is what we want you to be. And that I don't think is there to begin with, or at least it's not clearly there. If anything, the propaganda is more of a reverse propaganda. It tells you this is what the world is like. This is what the world could be like. It's almost a denazified Nazi utopia. You know, we no longer need the Blut und Boden. We no longer need the kind of the fascism. We've won. That's how it comes across. And now we can go back to a normalcy that excludes certain groups of people. So that, to some extent, is, I think, the propaganda heads. What I expected was much more the Leni Riefenstahl thing, you know, that you've got characters that clearly embody Nazi virtues and that you don't get. And that's surprising. And then it's even more surprising when they greet each other with Heil Hitler, because other than that, until the last 10 minutes of the film, the Nazis and Hitler seem weirdly absent, just like the war seems completely absent. It's escapism. And its propaganda to a large extent is exactly that. It's that escapism. And that's also what makes this film, as you said, you know, it's fun. It's charming. You don't want to say that about a Nazi film, but it is a charming film. It's dated, obviously, but it's also, there's a genuine feeling quality, for instance, to the agency of this woman. She is a photographer and she knows her stuff. She knows it better than most of the men in the film. And she's then not kind of put into a little box of, and now we basically put you into the home so you can have kids. She remains a working woman in a job that doesn't conform to the Nazi ideal of, you know, furthering the war effort. And that's weird. It's really weird and it's kind of disconcerting. But yeah, for a long time, I had the impression you could easily make an edit of this film that takes out all the Nazi stuff and the core of the film would still work. The bits at the end that are blatantly propagandistic, they almost come across as reshoots. It's like they suddenly remembered, oh yeah, we have to have some kind of, you know, Reichstag speech here. We have to have her kind of cheering, when is Hitler coming? We want to see Hitler. And it feels tacked on. It does not feel of a piece with the rest of the film. And I would imagine that even at the time, people would have felt this comes out of a different thing. So you've got the blatant propaganda, which feels tacked on. And then you've got the more subtle, insidious propaganda, which is basically all about escapism. War? What war?
Mm-hmm. That's what I was thinking. You know, how would I have seen the film had I not been prepared by the Suslan documentary about some of the strategies that are used in the more subtly propagandistic films? And I don't know if you also saw the version that had the little bits and pieces taken out whenever the picture seemed a bit murkier. You know, there was a Heil Hitler in there, or there was Goebbels' portrait in the back, or you saw the swastika sign on the wall. So apparently they had taken out these bits in versions that were shown later on in the 50s and later on to make it seem as if this wasn't a Nazi era film. So in a way that shows us a little bit how it works, right? It would almost work. Would you take out all the Heil Hitlers on the surface at least? But then what I felt like with the help of the documentary and with, you know, closer analysis, then to see how insidiously propagandistic it actually is, to lead us on thinking this is the independent woman arc that we know from other film cultures. And then I think can be seen as highly emancipatory and, you know, liberating. But then to see how she's actually attached to, you know, life in Berlin on the one hand and kind of leading this life, but she's still highly dependent on men and attaches herself to this man that then turns out was kind of her role model all along. And she gets married to him at the very end. And he is such a representation of, to me at least, you know, the way he was coded as, you know, the strong Nazi character type. He's not identified as that officially, but he reads as such. And you know, this super busy photographer and writer, and of course, her role model, as it turns out. But at the end, you know, where does her arc end? It ends in the attachment to this man that she kind of looked up at all the time. And I was wondering if he was also stylized as this, you know, leading figure again, that in the end helps her realize her dream coming out of this rural Bavaria.
I would kind of disagree with that, to be honest. I mean, for one thing, I think he is much more neutrally coded. I think in the other film that we're going to talk about afterwards, there's much more of the clear Nazi coding. I think, I don't know how conscious it was, but I think there's an almost apolitical coding, which itself is questionable. The thing is, yes, I mean, basically we get him saying, well, I don't like you doing that. I don't like you having a life of your own. And she says, tough, deal with it. And up to the end, I mean, she remains a professional woman and he has to accept that. Obviously, there's compromise on both sides, but basically just in terms of the character arc, it remains surprisingly modern to the end compared to films in America at the time, for instance. She does not have to suddenly subjugate herself to the man. Yes, she's attached to him, but that tension remains and I don't think it resolves it. And I think that's one of the interesting things, that it doesn't resolve it. We're not left with the, you know, her realizing, okay, I've had my fun as a professional woman, but now I have to go and bear children for the Führer. That's not there.
Here's where I'm at odds with myself. When I look at this film as cleanly as I can, and you've heard in the intro that I have very visceral issues with this type of material, one of the first things that weirds me out is that the man, the romantic lead, is coded as virtuous. almost offhand, like you would in an American comedy, right? You know who the good guy is or the everyman or whatever. And he's obviously a very successful, highly ranked man. And he's supposed to be the virtuous person. And then he acts like a total asshole. When she has a really big success and she has a book published, she has a little party and she gets a little tiddly. And he gets all up in arms about how she's disappointed him and how she is so much more than that and should have more self-respect than to get a tiny little bit tiddly at your own party, right? And this is where it signals to you that you're basically looking into a different world. And to me, but I'm not a historian, the ending is exactly the point. This is the point of the film. It feels tacked on, absolutely true. It feels almost alienating when you see it inserted in the film, these types of sort of virtues that are signaled. But that is the point of the entire film. She is not punished because she is independent. She is not punished because she is successful. She keeps her independence to a very large extent. I absolutely agree with you, Matt. Up to the very, 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 very end of the film in which she suddenly decides she's going to bear his children for all time. Yay. And they take off in the car, which is also so alienating. Anyway, but I think this should be viewed as an illusion of female agency and not as a propagation of female agency, if that makes any sense. This film does not endorse this kind of agency. It endorses an idea of there are particular people with a particular genius who kind of fall out of the rules. They're particularly brilliant. And that's why they get this exemption. This is also a very big Nazi bullshit thing that they tend to do. They love this idea of this one genius who can get away with things. And therefore, I think the fact that she is such an outlier sort of underlines the point that this is the escape from reality. As you say, very rightly, what war? Why Berlin hasn't been bombed. Berlin is in its full glory on the screen, even though it was bombed in the real life. The whole thing is a lie. That's how I view it. And I think we disagree a little bit with that because I don't see anything innocuous in this film at all. I think it was built to give you an imaginary out of an untenable life, right? So I see this as much more insidious than you do, which is massively interesting because that's why we're having this discussion. But I see it as the ending being the point. The whole, they have this wonderful scene of the Olympiade. I think it's an actual literal real life scene that was inserted there for this big Nazi propaganda Olympia festival with the football, which she is a part of. So all those signals of Nazi Germany, the sublimation of the individual and so on and so, it's all in there. You're just given the illusion that you can escape them for a while, right? This is how I view this it's a very insidious bit of work. Contradict me, please do.
I think we agree to a large extent. I'm kind of wondering whether we perhaps saw different versions because I think the thing is the ending. I mean, even before, I think the guy is supposed to come across as a dick because it's all coded very much like, let's say, for instance, it's not that different from Cary Grant being a dick in Notorious, ironically, which is about basically fighting the Nazi after
fighting
the war.
Fighting Nazis, yeah.
Exactly. But I think it is very much a controlling man. And I do not think that the film presents him as right or even virtuous, because the thing is, the film even makes the point that he is so focused on himself and his work and his professional identity that he's kind of standing in the way of his own happiness, which is also, again, a trope that you find in films like that, outside Nazi kind of Germany. I do think that the character arc, it does never resolve. And I do think that the main character there, what's her name?
Renate,
exactly. While she's exceptional in that she's extremely good at what she does, she is also coded as an idealized every girl. So I do think that the propaganda here is indeed, I would agree with you, you could be this too. It isn't, there are some people who are better than others and you can never be that. The illusion is you could be her. The film wants you to identify with her. And I do think that even in the scene where she's tipsy, the way it's played, it's not played as this is her downfall, this is her bad side. It's, I think, played as this is human. So in that respect, my reading, I think, of him more than her is different from yours. I mean, what I find so interesting about the ending where you suddenly have the end, now we've got 10 minutes of blatant propaganda.
It's so weird. There is no words on earth to describe how alienating this is. Go on, Matt.
The thing is that in order to make it more effective to some extent, let's say if I was a Nazi director, which thank God I am not, I would have interspersed that. I would have basically made that part of her life. But it's really like, it's like a different director walks in. He doesn't. It's still the same director. But it really, to me, came across as we've had the film, we've had the story, and now we've got, you know, kind of 10 minutes of propaganda. What I said before, you know, you could so easily edit this into a different film, and I could imagine it was even done or they tried to do it. I think the propaganda at the end, even if it was the point, it's probably where the propaganda, I would imagine, is least effective. It's much more effective before, where it tells you you can have a normal life under Nazi Germany. And that, I think, is the propaganda that I would imagine was more effective. The escapism that's built into there's no war going on, we're all happy, you can be what you want to be in the context of Nazi Germany. I would imagine that the last 10 minutes in the context of this film were the least effective at being propaganda. But that's obviously difficult to say. I mean, there's obviously also projection happening here.
Mm-hmm. But that's what I found so insidious about the film, right, is that that first part where you present it with that classic arc, or at least seemingly classic arc, and then the bit at the end. Good question whether that was added in retrospect, whether Goebbels, obviously we haven't mentioned him by name, and his great influence on every film that came out of UFA, of the production factory of Nazi filmmaking, whether they had something to do with, you know, making this more in line with propaganda, straight propaganda messaging. I'm not sure. I can't confirm that, but it does seem like a break. And it does seem also like the editing that I've mentioned makes it possible to present the film in a different way up to a certain point. If you cut the little bits out that we mentioned, the Heil Hitlers, etc. Yeah, you could take this even further and almost make it seem like, yeah, that's what we expected. But then comes the ending. And I think that's why I was more comparing it to something like Hitlerjunge Quex, that is also analyzed by Süsland, where you also have this journey of, in this case, a young boy in a kind of, you know, Weimar Germany family background. And then he is lured in by young Nazi groups into becoming one of their members.
He's with the communists first, I think.
He's with the communist youth first. Yeah. And then he discovers in the woods, in the forest, suddenly this camp of Hitler youth. And, you know, this is obviously much more blatant, like straightforward line. But in a way, this girl from Bavaria, you know, why is she from Bavaria? Why is she from this very idealized countryside, kind of close to the Austria-Bavaria
pastoral countryside, yeah.
Origin story and this mythology of, you know, Munich, the putsch in Munich of Hitler. So, I mean, you can read a lot into it, and I'm not saying this is the only way to read it, but I was wondering, for someone who was watching this, and you said it before, mostly probably a female audience watching this, what was the message that they put out for these? And I think there I agree very much with what you said before. There's some kind of message that says, you know, you can become this too. You can make this. You can become, in a way, this protagonist, but at the same time, you're being lured into saying, well, you know, we need women to step up because we're in the middle of the war. Men are at the front. We need a lot of the workforce, you know, women to come out of their countryside, maybe hideaways. And we need you for, I don't know, industrial production, or we need you in these places to replace men that have gone. So I also thought of this assumedly majority female audience that saw this film. What did they want to give them as the message to take away from?
I want to insert a tiny little history lesson, because I don't think we've underlined this enough. These films were made by a German state company, right? They were made by the state. Basically, Goebbels had a hand in them, from everything, from central casting to the script. It was not like, oh, we have some trusted directors, they can do what they like, right? The propaganda ministry was very involved in the nuts and bolts of these films. This I want to add this because it influences my reading of it, right? It's not like it's not a happy accident that snuck through or anything. Everything was personally approved by the Ministry of Propaganda. And of course, Liebenauer was a Nazi filmmaker. He was not some sort of renegade, right? He would have been shot if he were. So there's no subversion here. So the question of what we see in this now is so interesting, because we know its intent. right? We know it's propaganda. That's not the question, Sam. You put that rightly in the sort of pre-discussion that we had. It's not the question whether this is propaganda or not. I think we can all agree that this is propaganda. But how was this supposed to come across? And I think women, at the end of the war, it was a very, very tough time. You see it in the films of the era as well, the more propagandistic ones, in that the women are made to suffer and the absence of their men and their suffering is made noble because they are carrying the burden of this impossible war, which we're not going to say out loud is impossible, but it is impossible, right? This is the burden of women. They have to be virtuous. They have to work hard. They have to stick up for the Reich. You see this with a lot of those melodramas, right? With women alone and all that sort of stuff. And this is an outlier because, again, it gives the illusion of agency, right? It says, well, you could go to the big city and go work and make a life for yourself and make a career for yourself. But it's, again, my reading is it's merely an illusion. It's supposed to appeal to women who have a streak of independence that you need to control by the end of this war. You need to give them an out. Because otherwise they're going to rebel and say, why should I listen to you? Why should I keep being fed this idea that I ought to suffer and be alone and shoulder this burden for nothing? So why am I doing this? Well, this is why you're doing this. This is the illusion of independence. This is the idea of the big city of Berlin, of the glamour, of the exceptionalism of the Reich. Not you as an individual citizen, of the Reich itself, right? So this... that informs my view of it. And I think women needed an out. It was miserable at the time. I mean, the war was being lost a little bit later in Russia. It was absolutely hopeless. And you are asked to shoulder the burden of a crumbling Reich, which has promised you golden pastures. I mean, it must have been insupportable. And so the cinema, with its illusions and with its distractions and with its fun old stories of country girls making it big in the city, it's almost, if it weren't so well made, it would be cheap. So that's how I view it in terms of, I can't know how it was received. I know Liebenauer is a good filmmaker. I know Liebenauer is a good Nazi. He wouldn't have made anything that wasn't approved by the ministry. But I can also see from my vantage point into a different country, into a different world in which this was escapism, pure, as Matt rightly said, escapism in its purest form. The point is that it is a lie. Everybody knows it's a lie. Berlin is in ashes by the time this film comes out. The point is, again, I said this in the intro, not that people believed this lie or people believed that they had any agency. It's meant to appeal to the imagination. That's what I think. This is a very complicated diatribe that I've just, but I hope it makes sense, right?
Oh, it does. It does. I think it's, you know, delirious escapism even. I mean, with both of our films that we're going to talk about, the filmmaking is highly accomplished and they shot for months and months on this film and the editing is in parts extremely well made. But I'm also in, not only in two minds, but I think just in one mind about this. You know, this is a filmmaking machine that has been so professionalized at putting out these stories. So many films. I mean, we haven't even talked about the amounts of musical comedies that come out and all kinds of drama and comedies in general. All this escapist, I mean, Süsland in his documentary brings it out so well. Everything is escapism, but it's escapism with strong intentions. And this machine has been fine-tuned to, you know, the best bits, the development of camera techniques and perspectives. And I mean, this is highly accomplished, but to what intent? And with what sense?
This was a groundbreaking realization for me, just to lighten the load a little bit, that Nazis loved musical comedies, man. There were endless, like almost Busby Berkeley-esque choreographed, super organized, ordered musical comedies. It was like, I gasped. I was like, not Nazis, right? You don't associate Nazis with musical comedies somehow. The producers half got it right there. So many years later, with Springtime for Hitler and their satire, right? Because they did love their musical comedies, and small wonder, cinema is escapism, and Goebbels knew that quite well.
It's difficult not to think of the Coen brothers, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, where you've got the Busby Berkeley Ku Klux Klan rally, basically skewering that kind of ideology. I mean, the thing is with this film, I really do think that here, to my mind, other than the last 10 minutes, the propaganda is really almost more for me in pretending that Nazi ideology and authoritarianism can be ignored. Because the thing is, it is a big city comedy. It is a Berlin comedy. And also in the characters, in the positively connotated characters, there's a kind of messy, chaotic, almost anti-authoritarian element there. And it's not corrected. You know, basically the other photographer that she meets, he's totally this little cheeky Berlin guy who doesn't take authority without, you know, joking at it, making fun of it. So I do think here really where I see propaganda is less in the values it espouses and more in what it pretends isn't there in present day Germany. I think in that respect, the other film that we're looking at is much more intertwined with what I'd understand as Nazi values, although also there's a messiness there that makes it weird, that can be read as subversive, but I don't think it's an intentional subversion. Absolutely not. And we'll get at that. But what I wanted also to say is we're talking about the tightly controlled Nazi propaganda machine that obviously is there and existed. But the other film that we're going to talk about, Goebbels explicitly said he didn't like, which I find weird that you have. I mean, it doesn't negate anything. It was a tightly controlled propaganda machine. But even in a tightly controlled propaganda machine, you could make and release a film that the head of propaganda would say, oh, I don't like this. Which is, I think, just one of these human contradictions that's even inherent in a tightly controlled authoritarian fascist system.
As we're slowly segueing into the second film, maybe also to say, yeah, maybe the Großstadt Melodie has this sense of the screwball comedy as a major, you know, it seems like distraction, all kinds of little bits pop up that seem, you know, seem fun, seem quirky, seem like different characters, this big city comedy, but still the way where it ends up, you know, the journey takes, I think the manipulation cannot be denied, right? We're kind of in this fun ride and there's lots of little fun scenes and this hysterical energy that I think is also often in these comedies. It's not, to our eyes, it's not really funny, but there's certainly a lot of energy in it. There's certainly a lot of speed, a lot of editing speed, dialogue speed, and like on the surface, like it's very witty and funny. And of course, watching it now, it reads very differently. But I think you're right, Matt, when we look at the second film, we'll have a very different story when we look at Opfergang. But Julie, any last thoughts before we talk about the second film?
I have an intermediate note about subversion in Nazi Germany. And maybe you can help me out, Sam, because I'm so bad at names. There was a very famous actor and theatrical director, very successful one, who did musicals and films under the Nazi regime, who can be, with honesty, called subversive. And I think Goebbels didn't like him, but he was under protection by some other big Nazi bigwig. I forget whom. So in that sense, if you were protected, you get, as the documentary called it, dance on the volcano. You got to take a risk and put this teeny tiny little subversion into. So subversion does exist. Just to agree with Matt here, that did occur. I mean, Paracelsus by Pabst was approved by the Reich. And you could argue, I think, that that has actual critical and subversive elements in it. So I'm not denying that that existed, but only under the umbrella and with the protection of specific people within the Reich, and nothing as blatant as female agency, right? That is not meant to be subversive. That is meant to be there. The subversion in Nazi cinema is much more subtle. So, that could be a different podcast. How did subversion actually exist in Nazi cinema? But this is just to note that I'm not claiming that there were no subversive artists at all under Goebbels. I'm just saying that it was a different type of fishbowl, which was really tightly controlled, and you could be shot unless you had really big protection from really high up. And I'm sorry I'm so bad at names, I should have noted this down, but it did exist. So on to the weirdest film that we, in an era of weird films, the weirdest film, arguably, that was made in this system. Go ahead, Sam, because I am lost for words.
Yeah, I was lost for words when I first saw bits and pieces again in the Süßland documentary. Opfergang, released in December 1944, produced quite a bit earlier, was in that film called, you know, The Vertigo of Nazi Germany. Obviously, that immediately piqued my interest. And I think what weirded me out from the beginning was were these enormously strangely colored pictures of, you know, these highly complex interiors, just the stark color contrast between inside and outside, these two female leads, both of them archetypical, you know, Aryan ideals of women. Very different in a film, but still they're clear, you know, role models of the time. And just the slow pacing kind of hypnotic quality that these images had. So I think that's why I sought out this film in particular, and I got the Blu-ray, and it was restored in 2016 by the Murnau Stiftung. It has been reappreciated, shown at the Venice Film Festival in that year. So there has been kind of like a reappreciation of this film by Veit Harlan, who also did infamously Jud Süß, probably the most infamous propaganda film of Nazi Germany, who had done a number of other films and was one of the most famous, you know, accomplished directors of that era. And that's why I chose this for this podcast. So I'm very curious, because those were my first impressions when I saw the excerpts before we go into the entire film. Well, what were the weirdest things or the first impressions that you had from watching this strange late entry into Nazi cinema?
I mean, again, like the other film, I think it's a film in which the war is completely absent. And obviously, by the time this came out in 1944, that kind of escapism was probably even more important. This is where I don't know enough about Nazi cinema. I wonder whether at the same time they also had war films, which were all about the war effort and how we have to go and win the good fight from Nazi perspective. Here, what we have is the opposite. The war doesn't exist. The world out there, again, I think we have a world that looks like an idealized version of what if the Nazis had won. Idealized as in, you know, all of the negative elements or potentially negative elements, the brutal elements, the violent elements are kind of largely ignored. And we get this kind of weird ahistorical utopia in which, you know, Germany has colonized the world. And that is kind of there, but at the same time, the war is just not mentioned. It's not present. There's no destruction. They found the bits of Germany where no bombs had landed, and they all look nice and pristine, which is, I think that again is weird. It's a film that from the beginning, I think the film codes its women in such a blonde Nazi sweetheart way that it's almost kind of, it almost turns into parody, you know, none more blonde, to paraphrase Spinal Tap. And then you get into the story, and the story is just weird on an ideological level. I find this, I mean, it's again not what I expected in terms of Nazi ideology. It's there, but it's like you take a melodrama. I think it's also based on a book, right? Or a play. You take a melodrama and then you kind of put that through the Nazi ringer, and what comes out is such a mess.
Yeah, it's the most lurid of lurid of lurid candy colored picture of female oppression that I have ever had to experience. The redheaded woman, she was the wife of Harlan. And she was known in the Nazi sort of machine to always be sacrificed. She was killed in every movie she was in. She had the big death scenes. It's like in which she dies very melodramatically. That was her raison d'être on film, to be sacrificed.
Right.
This is this Nazi death culty sort of death wishy weird thing that they had towards the end of the war, where death was very much sort of shown as the ultimate sacrifice. This goes into the sort of weird Nazi psychology thing that I'm going to try and stay away from because it's insupportable. We have these two women, the wild Nixie mermaid lady who swims naked and is the sort of pinnacle of freedom, who, of course, has to be sacrificed because freedom, you know, you can't have that in women. You have to die from some obscure Victorian disease that nobody's ever heard of. And then you have the blonde Nietzschean virtuous lady who gives up everything for her husband, who constantly cheats, and she doesn't mind because it's all about him, she says so literally in the film. Then you get the title, the Opfergang, right? The sacrifice. Is the sacrifice of the wild mermaid lady or the sacrifice of the blonde Nietzschean ideal lady? It's the sacrifice of both to the gentleman at the center of it who has who is basically a toddler. The reason I would want people to see this is just to get an appreciation of how weird this is. This film is completely technicolor. You need sunglasses to watch it, right? It's like bright blues and bright reds and bright everything. And at some point we see a lady on a white horse in the surf of the sea shooting a bow and arrow from horseback as a kind of perverted Amazon. This is how weird this gets, right? And in contrast with a film like such as Vertigo, which you mentioned, this film doesn't seem to know where it's going. What is the point, right? As Matt says, it is a bit of a mess. It's just about the sacrifice and of these women. And that seems to be, the idea seems to be is that that's somehow noble. For no reason that is mentioned. Just it's noble in itself because women are oppressed. I don't know. I can't find my way around this film somehow. I'm sorry to be such a rambler, but it's so old.
But to me, you know, it represents the absolute decadence of Nazi cinema, starting with the colors and the set design and the perfection that every costume and every hairpiece and every moment in the film, the effort that has been put into it, right? And the decadence, I mean, also by, if you look who's in the background, this is Agfa color. You know, you mentioned Technicolor, but this is actually the process that Nazi Germany had developed with the help of IG Farben. And IG Farben famously was one of the main financiers of Nazi Germany in the background, bankrolling the Nazi party. And also famously, you know, having these labor camps planned close to Auschwitz-Birkenau. I mean, the production of these colors is made on the back of prisoners, of enemies of the state, forced labor. And this is the perfection that they have reached in color film at this point. So even that is like, it's grisly. It's, you know, nauseating if you think about it. That's why I mean decadence. There's something very deathly about this film, not just in its content and the story that it tells, but also the way it seems to you. It seems very enclosed. A lot of it is in studios, and even the outside, as you said, seems artificial. The colors seem too intense. They seem consciously overblown to create this vision of a world that does not exist, like you said, Matt. The absence of the war, I think, is even more jarring in this example, because it really is kind of a hypnotic mess that they want the audience to dive into, a melodrama about three people while the whole world is falling apart around the audience, basically. And again, I'm thinking of the people who saw this. Again, I would say even more so, a mostly female audience. So what were they taking away from this film? What were they supposed to take away from this film about sacrifice and death? And I think here the message is even more blurred. I think it's somehow, because it was a major hit, apparently, when it came out, people loved seeing it, apparently, from what I heard and read. So what did they love about it? Was it this kind of muddled sense of, you know, sacrifice is necessary? A woman needs to sacrifice for her husband, who's probably fighting at the front, who's maybe already died. This kind of almost telepathic connection between Christina Söderbaum and Karl Radatz in the film, where they seem to almost communicate, you know, across, and this blurs from one picture, from one scene to the other, as almost as if she's communicating already with a dead person or vice versa. So I think there's a lot of this coding of death, this yearning for the end, for dying as something good. I don't know.
But it isn't death as the end. It's death as kind of the promised land. I mean, you have the gate that is almost like the pearly gates. So there is this notion of, you're not just going to be gone. It's not, even though it's death, its morbidity is not the goth type morbidity. It's more the kind of Agfa color Christianity, weirdly enough.
Yeah.
Mixed with ideas of kind of Nordic mythology. I think it's a complete and utter mix. And that's also what makes it fascinating. I mean, you mentioned the luridness, but I think there are moments where I think the luridness is effective, except perhaps not in the way that the filmmakers intended. There are things here that seem, again, that seem subversive. I don't think they are, but I think they're in how many ideas are mixed here. It's not, you know, for instance, if you look at so much Hollywood cinema from then or even earlier, you might have you might have the good woman who's pure and virtuous, and you might have the bad woman who's basically the witch, and she's, you know, she's sexy and everything, but obviously she has to be disposed of. Here you don't have that. You have two clashing ideals, the good, pure woman, but also the Valkyrie on a horse who's Nordic to begin with. So I think you have two ideals, and both of these ideals are also, I think, criticized somehow, because, you know, you've got the wife, her family is basically, they're as morbid as it gets. On Sunday mornings, they sit in the dark reading poetry, and that is not, even if it's Nietzsche, it's not the Nazi ideal, because these are intellectuals in a bad way. Whereas the other woman, she's life-affirming, nature-loving. So you've got ways in which the good, pure woman is undermined. And then you've got ways in which the Valkyrie is undermined. She's a single mother and she kind of abandons her child. It's understandable to some extent, but still, she does not do what you'd expect, you know, kind of Nazi women to do. And in the end, what you get is this weird thing, you know, you have to take the good elements of both women, you have to kill off the bad elements of both women, and then you have to create a composite. You know, the good, pure wife takes on some of the qualities of Else once Else is dead in an almost vampiric fashion.
I'm going to disagree with you both. This film, I think, was such a success because it is made for women. And it doesn't demonize Söderberg or Else, the Nixie mermaid lady, for that reason. It is meant to appeal to women who are active and earthy, and meant to appeal to women who are intellectual and distant. It's meant to appeal to all women and to tell all women, whatever their proclivities, to sublimate themselves. They are there for their husbands. They are there for the Reich. That is their only fate. And I'm not going to even say purpose, because it doesn't arise in this film. It is determinism. It's their fate. It is their glory. It is their virtue. There's a scene in this film, it weirds me out in so many ways, in which Else, in a white suit, this is significant, walks through the town towards what ends up to be her daughter. She's, as you say, a single mum. And blonde Nazi lady follows her in a kind of obsessive way throughout the scene. And her friend is trying to stop her and tell her to not make a spectacle of herself, but she seems magnetized by this woman. And she runs after her and she says to her friend, she says, "It's this woman, what is it about her? She's like a magnet. All men look at her." And she sees herself as somebody who is, you know, too distant for that. She is, as her friend puts it, above all that, right? The earthy and the intellectual, or the divine. She's very much associated with the divine, some sort of, I think, Japanese goddess or something. I don't know. Nazis. And this scene was so fascinating to me, because I was like, what does this signify in a film that is about female sacrifice? It's called Sacrifice, for heaven's sakes, right? What does this mean? And again, this is what I struggle with. It's like looking through binoculars into a different world in which you can't decode what should have been obvious for audiences at the time. And the reason I think it stuck to people, and the reason I think they loved it so much, is because it ennobles the sacrifice. If they had judged Else for being earthy or sexy or whatever, it wouldn't have worked, because it's her ennoblement that's necessary for the ennoblement of all Nazi ladies, whatever their proclivities, as long as they're Nordic and not, like, you know, anything else than perfectly fit and perfectly able until they just drop down dead out of thin air and then have telepathic capacities as well. Nazis, go figure. And ennoble death. So I think we've disagreed about this slightly before. I think what you see as the aberration in this film is actually the point of this film. What we view as reasonably normal melodramatic arc is not the point. The aberrations are the point within the film. This is where we differ on, I think, most of these weird Nazi outliers. Goebbels didn't even like it, I don't think.
Well, he did not like the ending, apparently. He called it, you know, totus erotic. So I think he was relatively fond.
That's rich coming from him.
Go figure. But from what I hear or read is that he minded the ending, which was also majorly changed from the novel that it was based on, because in the novel, actually, the male protagonist dies. And so that was a change that they made. But I think he particularly minded this modeled, you know, telepathic ending, the way this was presented. But he didn't mind the film. So I think, you know, I would agree with you that, again, for the mostly female audience, this message of sacrifice, which I think must have been even more confusing, must have been just as confusing at the time. It's not a straightforward message, right? It's not, you know, what kind of sacrifice is it? It's somehow linked to all this Nazi mythology, the Nordic parts, the Nietzsche, you know, the bourgeois background of some supporters of the Nazis versus the, you know, more folkish background that included this Nordic mythology, that they were interested in this mysticism that's also there, I think, with Asian cultures as well. I thought that bit was interesting at the beginning, where you see that there was also a major interest of Nazis in other mysticisms, trying somehow to make sense of this with their own toolbox of ideology, Nazi ideology being such a mess of different bits and pieces of ideological elements from all over. So I think that must have, you know, struck a chord with audiences, but I'm not quite sure if it was as straightforward as, for instance, in Großstadt Melodie, where it, you know, this is kind of put tacked on at the end. Here it's rather not diluted, but becomes this huge, rather confusing big ending, right?
I'm also thinking that this may simply be because, you know, at this point in the war especially, you had contradictory messages that you wanted to convince your people of. You know, on the one hand, you know, we're going to an idealized world and we're already there, kind of, you know, the world is a great place under the Nazis. So you have to basically pretend this, you know, the war doesn't exist. But at the same time, people have to make sacrifices. There's less food. The men at the front are getting killed. So you also have to say, you know, there's no war, but at the same time, we have to sacrifice ourselves because that's a good thing. So I think the messages that propaganda at this point was trying to convey, we're getting more and more muddled, more and more confusing, more and more contradictory. And I can imagine that that expresses itself in the films as well, because you simply, the clear-cut narrative, you can't sell that at a point when your cities are getting bombed and your men are getting killed and you haven't got enough food.
Yeah, the more abstract, the better at some point, right? The more removed from reality, the better. And you see that the Nazis also have this propensity for historical dramas, right? We want to see the heroism of war, but not our war, not this one. The one with glory in it when we, I don't know, under Napoleon or whatever, the Preussish army fighting the French, that sort of thing. So I think you're right that they were seeking distance, right, between their reality and the films they put out, right? There's no such thing as a, you know, a documentary in the sense that we would understand it now, or realistic film as we understand it now, because it wasn't to the purpose of the Nazi machine, right?
Yeah, and I think Weitaarland's next film, Kohlberg, was then much more what you just described, Julie, this destruction of a past idea of German history by other armies. And this was much more this, you know, get up and put up the last stand of the last few months of the war. I think even at the very end, you know, the last film that was playing in Berlin cinemas before basically the Soviets rolled in. So this is a completely different story. I think here the escapism is so deeply entrenched, you feel you were so thrown as audiences into something else, something that is not there, something that has this, yeah, these fairy tale colors and this sense of unrealism. I'm thinking of this carnival scene in particular that is so eye-poppingly, and it's not of any world, it seems. You know, this doesn't seem like the original carnival that was going on at the time. It's highly artificial.
And fascinating. I mean, I have to say, you know, you can't deny that there's a skill here. In that scene especially, I found myself thinking of Tales of Hoffman, the Paul Pressburger. And I do think that these films clearly had an influence beyond their propagandistic value.
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the questions, kind of wrapping up questions that I would have for you is, you know, we've exposed ourselves now with all these trepidations and inhibitions and hesitations to these two films. What would you say is the major takeaway for you looking back at these films? What is the quotation mark, merit of looking at them? Are they worth that hesitant look inside the poison cabinet? And have they left any marks after 45? You know, you just mentioned that they might have influenced other filmmakers. Or is it really a box that was shot, you know, during the denazification after 45 and said, okay, we're going to lock these 1,300 films or so away and they're going to stay in that poison cabinet and nothing will seep out? So what is your takeaway looking back?
What shocked me, and of course I have seen Nazi films before. It's not like, you know, I went into this blind, but they do have power. And at the moment, some of them have been deplatformed and they knock about on YouTube, right? And as we spoke about with Kronstadt Melodie, you can just run into one without knowing its purpose. So, and they do have power. Some of them are very well made and some of them are even in their own sort of perverse way compelling. And again, I think there is fertile ground for ideas like this to land on, right? Ideas of exceptionalism, ideas of that there is a better world somewhere where not all these people who are not like us exist at all. The Gorstadt Melodie is interesting if you look at, is there anyone who is disabled in there? No. Is there anyone who is of color in there? No. There are a certain type of people, that's the only type of people that are allowed to exist in this cinematic universe. So I think they are powerful. And I think that you always imagine, or at least I do, that you are somehow inoculated against this. You know your history, you know your movies, you know your, I mean, the Nazis didn't have a monopoly on propaganda. I mean, a lot of films are propaganda. But I sort of surprised myself in thinking, is there a merit to these? Can I find a merit to these, right? I was always almost looking for something to not excuse them, but to give them a reason for existing beyond being a tool of the Reich. And I think that's the temptation. And I think for me, but that's a personal thing that we each have to decide for ourselves. I don't think there is. I don't think they have merit. I think they should be, as Matt rightly put it at the very beginning, and you did, Sam, as a historical artifact. Because I think that's the only way to approach them, with a great deal of suspicion. Because they are compelling in some ways, right? And they serve only one purpose. That's why they were made. They are not there to entertain us now. They're not made for staying power. They were made to serve this one monstrous thing. That's my takeaway.
How about you?
I mean, from a historical point of view, and even from a point of view of film history, I do think people who study film should also look at films that are horrible, distasteful, bad, ideologically, highly problematic. I think there is a point to, for instance, watching these films just as there is a point to watching something like Birth of a Nation with a critical eye, with an awareness of context. That is absolutely, I think, you know, anyone who's really interested in film has to expose themselves to all parts of film, obviously not willy-nilly. I'm not going to go out and watch every single Nazi propaganda film. No one will. But I think excluding these films, if you come at it from a point of view of history or film history, I think is problematic because they are part of film history. They also, we're talking about the box, but obviously, you know, the people who made Nazi films, they made films before, they made films after, they were influenced by others, they did influence others. And I think if you ignore that, you're ignoring a puzzle piece that will also make it more difficult for you to understand what's happening. Already, if you watch Star Wars, it helps to suddenly see that, okay, George Lucas found himself inspired by Leni Riefenstahl, her composition, and then address that critically, because I don't think he did that. I don't think he did it critically. It was just like, oh, nice composition, let's use it. By the way, I do think that there are some of the telepathic scenes in the Star Wars trilogy that to me looked very much like the Opfergang telepathy just before death in the way it's cut and filmed. Beyond that, I mean, I do think the films should be presented with context as much as possible. That's where I find it problematic if they just float around. But I also think the risk of someone coming across Großstadt Melodie and being propagandistically influenced by it is small. The people who seek out these films, I think, are mostly people who are interested in film history. I think in that respect, modern propaganda, which is floating around much more, much, much more, and much more readily available, and it's being pushed by the algorithms, is much more dangerous. But I do think ideally these films should be preserved and contextualized. I think governments have a duty to preserve cultural artifacts and contextualize them as they would in museums, as they would in archives.
I have a question to you both before I forget. I read an article about a sensible film person, apparently, published on the BFI, which dealt with Opfergang and which saw in it kind of early queer film, as if the two female protagonists were basically meant to be in a sort of lesbian love relationship. That was the treatment of this film critic. He is perfectly entitled to that opinion, right? What I'm saying is not that we should close the poison cabinet, put it under lock and key and never look back. What I'm saying is that we should have great deal of care to project these types of readings on films that were not meant to signal that. Now, intent is not everything in filmmaking, right? You can read into it whatever you like. I don't care. You can read it as the ultimate feminist. I really don't mind. But I think that I agree with very strongly with Matt, even I think more so, is that we need context with these films because this is not why they are there. You can read it into them, you know, but it's not like Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, where you have Jack Cole inserting these musical scenes that are meant to signal this queer coding that Howard Hawks had no problem with and was very hands-off about and didn't really mind. These things were meant to be the way they are to a very large extent. And I think people should be aware when approaching these, that that's what they are. Even the documentary, however good it is, has the same temptation that I do to see something, some subconscious, some wishful thinking bubbling up in the Nazi brain and somehow finding ways through the cracks to express themselves. I just don't think that's true. So I'm even more forceful than Matt is in that we should see these films very definitely, but we should see them with their context in place and not just out of the blue because they're so nice and colorful and they have women in swimsuits on white horses riding in the surf and shooting bows and arrows.
Well, you know, these two words that came up a lot now were context and I would say also continuum. So I would like to pick up on these maybe. I think I also agree we should see those films and be very, very aware of the context in which they were made. I think we can insert such readings into films that were made under different circumstances in a different context where such, you know, freedoms were possible. Here, clearly, they were not. And we cannot see things in them that were just impossible to realize during a time like Nazi Germany. So I think we have to be very careful about this, contextualize it properly, but watch it, I think, as elements of propagandistic and manipulative strategies in general. I think Nazi Germany and Nazi cinema seems to me such a often blatant, but also, as we saw, kind of an insidious chapter in movie history that where that can be seen in so many different ways, and not just the most obvious ones, but also the ones that we identified in Großstadtmelodie and Opfergang. And I think it is worth looking at them. I'm also thinking again of a source material, you know, why you could watch Triumph of the Will and identify all these clear, you know, camera perspectives and obvious ways in which Nazi mythology and marches are shown. But I think it's just as important to show them at a level where this sort of escapism and more muddled messages gets in. Because I feel the continuum of that, to take this, the second word, is that, of course, to a certain extent, that box was closed and identified as such, and these films were little shown and put into context later on when they were restored. And I think with a high awareness, especially also from, you know, German history side, what they were, what they are. But at the same time, of course, there is still a lot of, like you said, Matt, means of propaganda around. And I think just to compare the messaging, maybe, you know, to see, are there elements of propagandistic messages that can be compared? For instance, luring young men into a movement or certain ways of thinking, the role of women and how progressivism is maybe used as a way to re-traditionalize the role of women in society. So I think there are things in there, if you take them within their context and you see this is what was done during these circumstances, and to see that, like you said, Matt, that a lot of the filmmakers then also continued working, a lot of the actors and actresses continued working in post-war Germany. There is a continuum, not just of the people involved, but I think also the tendency when a society becomes more totalitarian that, of course, such means of propaganda are employed again. And I think it's important to know what these means of propaganda are and what they have been in the past. Otherwise, I think we're losing that critical look at how people can be manipulated into something extreme. So I think that's why I would say, you know, don't watch them all the time. But I think if you watch them, that's something definitely really important worth taking away from.
Can I perhaps respond to what you said, Julie, about the... I mean, I would totally agree with you. If anyone came and said, well, actually, Opfergang is this big proto-queer film, I would totally have problems with that. I do think there is a point to reading texts against the grain, because I think all art is made up of so many different voices, and there are kind of... there are subtexts that are not intentional. And there's another thing there. I think it can also be a way of subverting these texts from the present, not saying that the Nazis were subversive here, you know, the directors here were subversive, but saying that I could, for instance, imagine an almost, you know, Fassbinder-style remake of Opfergang that ends exactly with the guy dying, because let's face it, he's such a complete drip, and the two women ending up together as a way of kind of presenting a counter-reading. And I mean, it's also like if you look at Nazi aesthetics, where some streams of Nazi aesthetics were kind of taken up and parodied, for instance, in certain streams of queer aesthetics as a kind of, you know, parodying, as a kind of way of reappropriating. I do think there is something to be said for that. The one should not replace the other. I think a historical and historicized reading is absolutely necessary. But I think we should also have a freedom to kind of do things to these texts to change them. You know, they came out of a twisted ideology. I think artists can twist them into something else. But I think that also is something that's done better, more effectively, by knowing where they came from, knowing the context.
Yeah, I'm not of the Werner Herzog train of thought, who said I went back all the way to Murnau and 1920 because I just didn't want to touch all that Nazi shite. Basically, I'm paraphrasing him. Sorry, Mr. Herzog. But that's basically what he said. I'm not of that bent. But what I do think is important, and I sort of think we tend to forget, is that it's not about the lie in the film. Like I said at the beginning, it's not that you need to believe every specific lie that's being pushed on you. The risk here, the risk of all propaganda, not just Nazi propaganda, is that it erodes the sense that there is a material difference between lies and the truth. And there is a difference between lies and the truth. And when we give these films what all, and we should, I mean, I was tempted to do this podcast in a flaming pink flamingo dress with a hat on just to give them, you know, a piece of my mind, the whole Nazi regime.
Note to the listeners, for all you know, she is doing exactly that.
Who knows? But we need to do that with a very real sense of what the lie is. And I think we need to speak truth to power to get another whopping cliche in there. I'm so sorry to my listeners. I'm all for the cliches today. And not be befuddled by whether there is such a thing as truth, because there is. And these were Nazi films and they were made by Nazis. Mock them relentlessly. I will have fun with it. I will love that all the way because I hate them just as much as you do. But I think we need clarity on what these are and not fool ourselves into thinking there is merit there that is just not there. They're very pretty, but they are not a queer analogy. They're very pretty, but they do not promote female agency. Let's just tell it as it is.
And it is worrying, you know, to see if you look at reviews of the film on IMDb and other platforms, that of course there is that recontextualization of just taking the film and looking at it and saying how pretty it looks, how good the music is. I mean, you could point out all these qualities, but I think it's also worrisome that this has happened, right? That context has been stripped for just casual viewers of these films. So yes, listeners, if you come across these films, put them in the right context, read up on them. There is good material. And I think Hitler's Hollywood is a good starting point to many of these films and have at least the general context in there, and to really approach them with trepidation, but also with, I think, a curious mind, because I think, as we saw in this episode, there is a lot to be taken from this view of this very specific chunk of movie history, but treat it with the necessary care and necessary critical mind. I hope we have done this topic justice today. So thank you very much, Julie, and thank you, Matt, for joining me for a challenging but hopefully worthwhile episode. And to our listeners, join us again for another installment in our summer series, possibly the last in our Lost Summer, and for other episodes of A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for sticking with us. Goodbye.